Hard work pays off. Dreams come true. Bad times don't last, but bad guys do.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
This week, one of the greatest matches in WrestleMania history took place. The Rock against Hollywood Hulk Hogan in the Sky Dome in Toronto. However you define a five-star match, that was a five-star match. And it's the match that I most wish I was live in the building to see, because I've rarely seen a crowd that large go that crazy as they did when Hogan hulked up and The Rock kicked out of the leg drop. It's one of the greatest matches with one of the greatest calls. When Hogan dropped the leg and Jim Ross shouted that he beat Andre the Giant with that move. Simply perfect. This is episode 748 of the Solo Monster. Can you believe it's been 20 years? It's crazy. Episode 748 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 20th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. The wrestling world lost a legend this week. That is the top story for this week. We also have the definitive update on Cody Rhodes, where and when you can expect to see him. A major rumor on what will be closing night one of WrestleMania, and it may not be Charlotte Flair against Ronda Rousey. Jeff Hardy speaks about his final night in WWE and whether he was intentionally trying to get out of his WWE contract. And WWE finally admits that AEW has been a big success and what it took to finally get them to admit that publicly. So we have a lot to get into here, all that and a lot more. I want to thank everybody who sent in a PayPal this week. If you would like to do so and support the podcast, thesolomonster.com, you'll see the drop a PayPal link at the very top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers, including Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills. Thank you, Michelle. Always good to hear from her, and always good to hear from awesome Anthony Anguiano. Anthony, I just sent you an email back about something else, but thank you to him. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar. Big B, Brian Becerra. Killshot, Keith Hart. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine. Still dancing. He's still the dancing fool. Harrison Soep. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. John Raging Mad Riffle. Jay from Philly. Hope you're doing well. Razor's Edge, Robert Fox, who has been a fan of the show since 2012 and wants to send a shout out to his girlfriend Shannon, who he has been with for 7 years as of this Wednesday. What are you waiting for, brother? I may swoop in and steal her away from you. Robert, thank you. And congrats to the both of you. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. You've heard that name quite a few times over the years here on this podcast. Cody has a podcast of his own called Access Code, where he discusses music, sports, other topics, but he also does interviews. And this week, he interviewed a very special guest, me. And the episode drops this Tuesday, the 22nd, so you better go check it out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Podbean. Shout out to Casey Is Raw, who just celebrated his 40th birthday on Friday. Happy birthday, Casey. You can check out his YouTube channel of the same name. It's easy to remember. Casey Is Raw, where he goes video game hunting. I saw that Game Genie that you found the other day. I saw that video. That brought me back. I had a couple of Game Genies myself. Any kind of cheat codes I could get my hands on back in the old days of the NES and the Genesis. So anyway, he posts videos about that kind of stuff. Also gameplay videos and console reviews. So check out Casey is Raw on YouTube. And last but not least, Joe War Machine Wearing. I know Joe is trying to kick alcohol addiction right now as we speak. It took 15 years of him hiding it. But I want you to know, brother, I know you're listening. I know you are. It took courage to do what you're doing right now. I'm here for you. I'm rooting for you. We all are. Every single person listening to this right now, that's a lot of people. So get better as long as it takes, and you're going to come out of this a better man than you were before. Takes a lot of guts for someone to admit that they have a problem. That's only one step. The next step is to do something about it. And that's what you're doing right now. So keep me posted on that, and I'll be here cranking out the content for you. Quick reminder, this Wednesday, March 23rd, is 25 years after WrestleMania 13. Not one of the best WrestleManias of all time, but it did have one of the greatest matches of all time in WWE. And that is what we are going to be watching live on YouTube. If you are a channel member, we're going to be doing our second live watch-along Wednesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. That is the current plan time-wise. 1 p.m. Eastern, we're going to be watching Bret the Hitman Hart against Stone Cold Steve Austin, the submission match with Ken Shamrock as the referee from WrestleMania 13. So stop on by Wednesday afternoon. And then, of course, I'll be with you live Wednesday night for everybody for the usual Dynamite review. The wrestling business has lost a lot of people, you know, well before it should have been their time to go. People in their 30s and 40s, you know, let alone their 50s and 60s. Some of those people, they lived a very hard lifestyle. That's just the reality of it. They came up in a different time, they had certain vices, and they lived a very hard lifestyle. And in some cases, it was less surprising to find out that they had passed away. You've heard of these celebrity death pools. You know, who's going to be the next one to go? You know, really morbid stuff. Well, there were wrestling ones too. And two names that would always come up online in these wrestling death pools were Jake the Snake Roberts and Scott Hall. This is when the two of them were at their lowest point. Rehab wasn't working. You know, Stephanie McMahon once told ESPN that WWE spent six figures sending Scott Hall to rehab over all these years. It was the most amount of money that they ever spent on treatment for a single person. I believe he went to rehab 12 times. He claims he paid for the first six times, and WWE paid for the next six. But at least a dozen times, they sent him to rehab, and it just didn't stick. There were stories of them, you know, the two of them showing up at independent shows, completely wasted, stumbling around. Not even just stories, but, you know, recordings, videos that would be posted online of them stumbling around. And with Scott, of course, it was the infamous show in Fall River, Massachusetts. In 2011, that might have been the most infamous. He had just gotten out of the hospital. He's barely able to stand. I think he still had the hospital tag around his wrist. Couldn't even stand on his own two feet, had to be helped into the ring, you know, wearing his outsider's jacket, posing like he's cool. Meanwhile, he has no idea where he is. Clearly in no condition to be out there. It was embarrassing. And as a fan who grew up watching these guys, you know, I grew up watching Jake the Snake Roberts, and I grew up watching Razor Ramon and people like that. You feel helpless to do anything about it. Like, it's only a matter of time before you read about them being found dead in a hotel room, or dead in the ring, or God forbid, like Macho Man, you know, keeling over the wheel and driving off the road. And what can you do? These are grown adults who are going to do what they're going to do. You just hope that they don't hurt anybody else or take anybody else down with them. When Diamond Dallas Page decided that it was time to help Scott Hall, it was DDP, Jake Roberts, who by that point was already on the mend himself and doing better. Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman. They all came together to try to help their friend get his life back on track. When they got to Scott Hall, I'll never forget the phone call when DDP and Jake called him. They played the audio of that call. He told Dallas, he goes, "Dally, I'm dying. I'm dying." He said he was drinking vodka for breakfast every day. He would sometimes call his friends on the phone and say goodbye after threatening to kill himself. You know, when he went to finally go stay with Dallas, remember the video of him being wheeled through the airport in a wheelchair? He had finally decided to go move in with DDP. Scott Hall at that point, as awful as he looked, was only 54 years old. And he had already been diagnosed with congestive heart failure. He had a pacemaker already implanted in his chest. He was taking 11 different medications every single day. And he was in desperate need of a hip replacement. So they set up an Indiegogo campaign to try to crowdfund the $80,000 that he needed for the surgery and the physical therapy. They ended up raising over $109,000, well over their goal. And it really showed just how much of an impact he made on a lot of people, that so many of them came out to support him the way that they did. He got his hip fixed. He started doing DDP yoga. He got sober, although that didn't last. But he seemed to be in a much better place than he was in before. The Grim Reaper was knocking on this man's door, and he kicked out. On March 1st, Jerry Jarrett posted on Facebook that he had gotten off the phone with Scott Hall and that Scott had fallen and broken his hip and he was in the hospital. And when he fell, he was laying on the floor for days, unable to get to the phone until DDP went to go do basically a welfare check on him because nobody had talked to him in a few days. They were worried about him. They couldn't get a hold of him. And that's when he found Scott on the floor and he took him to the hospital. I don't know if it was the same hip that was replaced years earlier, but he went under the knife. And during that operation, there was a complication. A blood clot had gotten loose. He suffered 3 heart attacks, and he was placed on life support. And on Monday, his best friend, Kevin Nash, posted on Instagram that once Scott's family was all gathered and in place, they were going to discontinue life support. He said, "I'm going to lose the one person on this planet that I've spent more of my life with than anyone else. My heart is broken and I'm so very effing sad. I love Scott with all my heart, but now I have to prepare my life without him in the present. I've been blessed to have a friend that took me at face value and I him. When we jumped to WCW, we didn't care who liked or hated us. We had each other, and with the smooth Barry Bloom, we changed wrestling both in content and pay for those a lot that disliked us. We were the outsiders, but we had each other. Scott always felt he wasn't worthy of the afterlife. Will God please have some gold-plated toothpicks for my brother? My life was enriched with his take on life. He wasn't perfect, but as he always said, the last perfect person to walk the planet, they nailed to a cross. As we prepare for life without him, just remember there goes a great guy, and you ain't gonna see another one like him again. See you down the road, Scott. I couldn't love a human being any more than I do you." Scott Hall passed away later that day. He was 63 years old. When I first read the news about him having the 3 heart attacks and being placed on life support, that was at the start of last week's podcast, I pretty much knew what the lead story was going to be on this week's show. You know, you hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst. After everything that he had been through, all the bumps, all the partying, all the pills, all the booze, the heart issues, this man cheated death so many times. And in the end, it was a blood clot during surgery that did him in. But the illusion that Scott Hall was back on the wagon and doing well, you know, after his time with DDP, was pretty much shattered by Sean Waltman in The Observer this week when he said that the pandemic really did Scott in. The last 2 years were as bad as ever. being isolated at home, not being able to get out and interact with anybody. I mean, there were certain conventions and appearances and stuff, although probably not many over the last 2 years. And it just really ate away at him. And he started drinking heavily again. Apparently, he passed out at the bar before last year's Hall of Fame when the NWO got inducted. And there were stories of him not being in any condition to fulfill certain appearances and signings that he was supposed to do. I remember it may have been a virtual signing that he was supposed to do for High Spots that he missed. And because I was going to watch it. You know, occasionally, I think they just had one with the Hardy Boys, actually, the other day. You know, if I'm in the middle of just working on stuff or whatever, and I hear there's a virtual signing going on, occasionally I'll, you know, click on the Facebook video, and it's just the wrestler, you know, usually with the owner of High Spots, Michael Bukkicchio, just sitting at a table and signing various items and telling stories and stuff. And I remember hearing Scott Hall was going to do one, and he wasn't there, and they said, today's not a good day for Scott. And you kind of knew what that meant. Scott Hall, for all the progress that he made all those years ago, in the last 2 years of his life, had fallen right back into that black hole. And a lot of his problems can be traced back to the fact that both of his parents, his grandparents, his father in particular, were all alcoholics. He's from a family of alcoholics. So I know it's shocking that when you're from a family of alcoholics like he was, that you end up becoming an alcoholic yourself. But that's really where a lot of his problems can be traced back to. It explains a lot. And forced him to grow up a lot quicker. And there was also the shooting incident as well, but he himself has said in certain interviews that, you know, he would go to rehab and finally they were trying to get to the root cause of what the issue was. Because for all those times WWE would pay to send him to rehab, again, 12 times, he said, I took it seriously, I went, I did the classes, I listened, I participated, but it just didn't work for me. It didn't stick. Until finally they said, you're trying to treat the symptoms here of something that is underlying. You treat the symptoms all you want, you're not going to get to the root cause of the problem. We got to get to the root cause of what's causing you to drink and do all this stuff in the first place. And that's when he felt like he was starting to finally make headway. And he goes, yeah, the shooting incident was one thing, but he really said that it goes back to, again, his family history of this stuff. But there was an incident that also played a role. Back when he was 25 years old, he was bartending at a strip club. He talked about it publicly for the first time, or one of the first times, in his E60 documentary a number of years ago. That's the first time I had ever heard him talking about this story. As he told it, he got into an argument with another man. It was over a woman, of course. What else is new? The guy went outside, this is according to Hall now, the guy went outside and smashed all the windows on Scott's car, and when Scott went outside, you know, the bouncer, he's like, where is he? And the bouncer says, over there. He slugged the guy. The guy went down, his shirt went up, and Hall noticed him reaching for a gun. And Scott tried to wrestle the gun away from him, he took the gun, and then he aimed it at the guy's head, and he fired one shot, point blank, and he killed him. What he didn't say in that documentary, and this comes from an article in the Orlando Sentinel the day after the incident, is that the man he shot and killed was a manager at the club, basically his boss, and that the woman that they were fighting over was the man's wife, who Scott had allegedly been seeing on the side behind the guy's back. That's according to another employee who worked at the club. And the manager had threatened to kill them both. And when Hall got to the club for work that night, he pulled his car in, and when he got out, the manager was there to confront him with a gun. And what's even crazier is that the man that Scott killed, he himself shot somebody dead the month before that. He shot and killed a guy that he claimed had attacked him after making advances towards his wife. And it was ruled a justifiable homicide. Sounds like a jealous husband to me. But in any event, that's the event that really set Scott Hall up for a life of addiction, because he never sought the help that he needed after what he did. And Hall was charged with second-degree murder. And the case was eventually dismissed due to lack of evidence. And he said years later he didn't know any better. He should have sought counseling after what happened, but he never did. He just tried to bury it. But you can't run away from something like that. That shit'll chase you all the way to the very end. That's enough to mess with anybody's head. My first exposure to Scott Hall was in the WWF as Razor Ramon. I didn't see him as part of American Starship with Danny Spivey or, you know, his stint in the AWA as, you know, Big Scott Hall with the porn stash or as the Diamond Stud in WCW. For me, it started with the vignettes they shot in Miami to build to his debut. You know, which were some great vignettes. Not the best that WWE ever did. I still say the best that WWE ever did. It's either the Mr. Perfect vignettes or the Million Dollar Man ones. It's one of those two. But the Razor Ramon ones were great. You know, and he had the accent and the toothpick and the gold chains. He was doing the Tony Montana character from Scarface. You know, when he came to the WWF, he asked Vince McMahon if he had ever seen Scarface before, and Vince said no. You know, Vince McMahon was deep, deep into the bubble for him not to have known about Scarface. I'm surprised he didn't have them put scars all over the man's face when he debuted. But I know it sounds ridiculous now, but, you know, as a 10-year-old, I didn't know any better. He sounded Cuban to me. You look back at it now, having seen him dressed like a cowboy years earlier, speaking in his normal accent, it sounds preposterous. But Razor Ramon was cool. You know, the name sounded cool, he looked cool, he carried himself like a star. He had a cool finisher. Up until a few years ago, I couldn't even think of a single time anybody had ever kicked out of the Razor's Edge. At least in WWE. I could not think of a single instance in which anybody had kicked out of that move. And this was back when finishes were largely protected, unlike today. And I thought, man, in all those years, nobody ever kicked out of the Razor's Edge. And then the illusion was shattered when I saw a video of a match that he had with Crush on an episode of All American Wrestling in 1993. Kona Crush. Babyface Crush. And I'll be damned, Crush kicked out of the Razor's Edge. But, you know, even in that case, it was a delayed cover by Razor. He gloated for about 7 or 8 seconds before going for the pin. But I guess I can't say that anymore. The other thing I always loved about Scott Hall were his punches. He had one of the best worked punches that I have ever seen. Jerry Lawler. Lawler is probably the best that I have ever seen throw a punch in wrestling. Yeah, Jerry Lawler. Bret Hart is another one that I think of. And Scott Hall would be right at the top of that list. Jeff Jarrett threw a pretty good punch too. You know, Vader, I just talked about Vader last week going into the Hall of Fame. I don't even consider those punches. I don't even know what word I would use for those. Strikes? But those were no normal punches from Vader. I'm not really sure how worked those were. But again, his shit looked good when he was in the ring. And when he first came into the WWF, it was surprising how quickly, even to a young fan who, you know, I only knew of what I saw on TV. But it was weird. This new guy had just debuted, how quickly he was vaulted into the main event picture. He debuted on television in August. He actually wrestled Carmella's father in his debut, Paul Van Dale. 1 month later, he cost Randy Savage the WWF title when he lost it back to Ric Flair. And by November, he was in one of the two main events at Survivor Series, tagging with Ric Flair against Randy Savage and Mr. Perfect. 2 months after that, he was wrestling Bret Hart for the WWF title at the Royal Rumble. And they had a pretty good match, despite the fact that, you know, Hall blew his knee out a few weeks before the match. Could have been even better if he wasn't hurt. But a few months later in May, he did the job to Sean Waltman, one of the most famous matches in the history of Monday Night Raw. That was the birth of the 1-2-3 Kid. He made Sean Waltman. In a single night, he made Sean Waltman. And by the following month, the fans were starting to turn him babyface. So they did a little test. They put Razor in the ring with Shawn Michaels. It was heel against heel. You didn't see that very often in that period of the WWF. Heel against heel at Madison Square Garden at a live event. This was in June of 1993. And Hall fully expected that he would be the one getting booed over Sean. And in fact, the exact opposite happened, which shocked him. And at that point, they started the angle on TV with Ted DiBiase, you know, kind of mocking Razor and he lost to this kid. And that led to the Razor Ramon babyface turn, and that's what he was until the day he left the company in 1996. He was a fan favorite. When I think of the stars of that new generation era of the WWF, the first two names that always come to mind, kind of the leaders of that new generation, were Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. They were the top two stars. But then there was The Undertaker, there was Diesel, and there was Razor Ramon. So this guy was one of the faces of my childhood. You know, for me, it started with the Golden Era, and then it was the New Generation Era. I even started my own wrestling magazine. I called it New Generation Magazine back in 1996. I didn't realize this until a few days ago. I was putting my notes together, and it was 28 years ago to this very day. As I am sitting here right now on March 20th, 1994, that WrestleMania 10 was held at Madison Square Garden, which featured the first of two famous ladder matches between Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. This was the more famous of the two. People don't really talk about the SummerSlam one as much as I think they should, because I actually thought that was the better of the two matches. But this is the iconic one. And it ended with that image of Razor standing on the ladder holding up both Intercontinental belts. It's a legendary match. It's such a basic ladder match compared to the stunt shows that we see today, but it was, you know, it was a product of its time. It was the first one that ever aired on television or pay-per-view. You didn't have to do too much. It was still a novelty at the time. The novelty has long since worn off when it comes to ladder matches. We've seen so many of them. And now they try to squeeze as many people as possible into them, 6, 7, 8 people flying around all over the place. But they always replay Shawn Michaels doing the big splash off the top of the ladder. But honestly, the spot in that match that stays with me the most, there's a part of the match where Razor is up against the ropes. He's facing the crowd. He's selling. He's in so much pain. Hall's selling was incredible in that match. And Shawn Michaels, you see him in the background. He picks up the ladder above his head and he just chucks it at Razor Ramon. Throws it halfway across the ring and it hits him right in the spine. Even now, when I watch it back, that looks so painful. You can't work a spot like that. You can't work a ladder in a spot like that when it's flying halfway across the ring. He took that thing to the spine like a champ. But those two, they work so well together. And it makes me really sad to think back to the video that WWE did for their YouTube channel a few years ago. They got Shawn and Scott to sit down together and watch back the highlights of that match. It was 25 years after the ladder match. So they sat down to rewatch it. And at the very end of that video, you could probably still find it. I'm sure it's still up on their channel. The very end of that video, Scott turns to Shawn and he says, "Yeah, this has been fun." He goes, "Let's do it again in another 25 years. Now, I was just thinking about that the other day. And so that's tough. But I've said this before. Again, I enjoyed their second ladder match at SummerSlam in 95 more than I did the WrestleMania one. When I think of that classic Intercontinental title, there are certain people that I associate with that belt. Mr. Perfect is probably the first one that I think of, but Razor Ramon is right there with him. Four times he held that championship. And the more I think about it, as far as Intercontinental champs of the 90s are concerned, I might just put Razor Ramon at the top at number one. But when he left the WWF in 1996, I mean, Jesus Christ, I mean, who knew the chain of events that it would set off? It started with Hall leaving. That was the catalyst for everything that came after that. Scott Hall left first, Kevin Nash followed, and from that came this idea that, you know, Eric Bischoff wanted to use for an invasion, basically. And once Bischoff got Hogan on board to be the third man, we ended up with the greatest storyline of wrestling history. The most, certainly the most successful. It's the one from which everything else followed in the Attitude Era. Scott Hall walking out on Monday Nitro for the first time is one of the most important segments in the history of the business. think about the chain of events that it set off, not only in WCW, but in WWE as well. It's what led to those 83 weeks that WCW beat WWE in the ratings war. It's the whole reason Eric Bischoff even has a fucking podcast these days called 83 Weeks. You could trace it back to that moment. It's what pushed Vince McMahon back on his heels and forced him to make a change to his product. It led to the biggest boom period in wrestling history. I remember watching live that night. I bought into the hype that, hey, maybe there really is a crossover going on here. You really weren't sure, but you wanted to believe it because it's what every wrestling fan wanted to see at that time. Every wrestling fan wanted to see WWF against WCW. Or in their mind, they fantasy booked what matches they would do on a big supercard if we ever got WWF against WCW. An interpromotional war. All the dream matches you thought you would never see. It made things exciting. It made those shows on Monday night must see. It had me flipping channels back and forth every 5 minutes. I only had one VCR, so I could only tape one show. This was the challenge back then. No DVR. No YouTube. Scott Hall has the distinction of being part of some of the most memorable moments in wrestling. The ladder match with Shawn Michaels in Madison Square Garden. The curtain call. Also at Madison Square Garden. That first segment he did on Nitro. And Bash at the Beach, 96, when Hogan joined the NWO and all three of them celebrated in the ring, being pelted with garbage. So whether you like the guy or not, I'm not saying the guy was a saint, because he wasn't. But you can't deny his place in history and how big of a deal Scott Hall was during that time. I mentioned Razor losing to the 1-2-3 Kid as one of the most famous matches in Raw history. When the NWO came to WWE in 2002, they did a match on Raw 6 days before WrestleMania. It was 20 years ago this month, a match that I still can't believe they gave away for free with barely any build or promotion. It was Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash against Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock in a handicap match. So you can make that two of the most famous matches in Monday Night Raw history that Scott Hall was a part of. The star power in that match was insane. The only time Hulk Hogan and Steve Austin ever wrestled each other was in that match. And Hall was chosen to wrestle Austin at WrestleMania that year. And people were probably taking bets as to how long he was going to last. The answer was not very long. Not very long at all. Not even 2 months later, within days of the infamous plane ride from hell, the company fired him. And that was the last big run of his career. He did go to TNA. He spent some time in TNA for a few years after that, but he didn't do anything of note, certainly nothing positive, of note in wrestling after that. Once that last stint was done, and it was very brief in WWE in 2002, that was really the end of Scott Hall as a major player in a major promotion. When he was on tour in New Japan, even before that, in 2001, he went on tour in New Japan, Hall put over a young lion by the name of Hiroshi Tanahashi and told anybody who would listen that night, that kid is money. And Tanahashi never forgot that. He once said that Scott Hall was a big deal in America. I was always a fan of his. I remember watching his matches with Shawn Michaels and the WWF over and over. A classical type, he had the flashiness and the character where it counted, and a classical style when it came to getting it done in the ring. Remember Wrestle Kingdom this year? And the match that Tanahashi had with Kenta? The splash that Tanahashi did off the ladder? I said, what is that? What is that splash, that form on the splash as he came off? What does that remind you of? I said, Tanahashi was a big Shawn Michaels fan. It would not have surprised me if he did that on purpose as a tribute to that match. Well, he wasn't just a fan of Shawn Michaels, he's a fan of Scott Hall as well. And that's just one of many ways that you can tell how much that ladder match influenced so many who came after them. Not to mention, of course, all the TLC matches that we got years later. Those two guys in that match, that was the inspiration for so much of what came later on. I think it is fair to include Scott Hall's name on the list as one of the best to never have been a world champion. I would not put him above Roddy Piper on that list. Scott Hall would not be number one. Because Piper, I mean, Piper was just an incredible heel, especially back around 84, 85. WWE absolutely could have had Hogan chasing Piper for the world title if they wanted, and they still would have sold a lot of tickets and made a lot of money doing so. Hall, though, you know, he had all the tools to be champion. He had the look, he had the size, he could work. The time to do it, if you were ever going to put a world title on Scott Hall, I think the only realistic time to have done so would have been in late 1994. And that means that instead of going with Kevin Nash and going with Diesel as your chosen one, you know, Vince could have gone with Razor Ramon. I think Razor Ramon was popular enough that if they were willing to take a chance on Diesel, who up to that point had been a heel, you know, mostly a bodyguard, part-time wrestler, but had been a heel, then certainly there was no more risk in trying Razor Ramon in that role to see how well he would have done. But, you know, outside of that period, he was never going to be a world champion. In WCW, his issues outside of the ring, they never would have allowed it. He was his own worst enemy. But honestly, even though he could have been a world champ for a few months at some point in his career, I mean, forget Diesel for a second, because we all know why Vince went with Kevin Nash. There's 7 feet worth of reasons why. Put him on the side for a second. But the reason he was never going to be a world champion anywhere, look at who was on top in that era in the WWF. Who were the top two guys in that company? Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And Scott Hall was not better than Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. He wasn't. In WCW, who was on top? They had Hogan. Scott came in just as Hogan was turned heel. That heel turn breathed new life into Hulk Hogan. That added at least 5 years onto Hogan's career, did that heel turn. So you had heel Hollywood Hogan on top, who was easily the biggest star they had. You had Sting. Later on, you had Goldberg during that period where he was white hot. You couldn't argue his success and how over he was. When those three were on top and at their hottest in that company, Scott Hall was not bigger than any of those people. He was not bigger than Goldberg at his peak. He was not bigger than Sting. And he certainly was not bigger than Hogan. So while he had the tools to carry the top title, I think he could have done it. He wasn't better than the best. And I think that's the point that people miss with not just Scott Hall, but certain other people who might have been really, really good, but were they better than the best? Whether it be business-wise, whether it be their work in the ring, he was never better than the best at that time. It's just the way that it was. So it never worked out that way for him. There's also the story that Hall told before. I mentioned Sting a moment ago. I have to mention that because this is always wild to me, but there's the story that Hall told before about being the one to suggest the crow gimmick for Sting. Sting had never seen the movie before. He didn't know about the crow character. The actual story of how the crow came to be is a little bit different, as told by Mark Madden on Jim Ross's old Ross Report podcast in 2014. Madden worked behind the scenes for WCW at the time, even before he became an on-air announcer for them. He was, you know, doing magazine and hotline stuff, you know, behind the scenes in the company. And as he told it, there was a young woman who worked for WCW who had a fetish, I guess you would say, for the crow. Her boyfriend also worked for WCW at the time. I don't know what wrestler it may have been or whatever, but one night, to surprise her, said wrestler, I'm assuming it was one of the wrestlers, decided to have one of the WCW makeup artists apply the crow makeup to his face before he went to her hotel room that night. Fast forward a few days or weeks later, whatever it was, there's a conversation going on backstage about what to do with Sting. And it was Scott Hall who said, hey, what about that wacky makeup that so-and-so wore when he went to his girl's room the other night? And Madden goes, what, you mean the crow makeup? And again, as he tells the story, Scott didn't know anything about the movie. He had no idea. All he knew was that the makeup looked cool. But from that, that's how Sting ended up as the crow. And evidently, that was the story that went around the locker room at that time, or some variation of that story that Madden told. And so that is the, you know, more likely the actual sequence of events as far as how the Crow came to be. It wasn't necessarily a case where Scott Hall was, you know, he went to go see the movie and he loved it so much, or he loved Brandon Lee in the movie so much that he said, hey, you see that movie? You should dress up like Brandon Lee. Doesn't sound like he knew what it was either, but at least he had enough sense to say, hey, Sting might look cool if he were to wear that makeup. And I mean, without Hall mentioning that, there is no Crow Sting. And it was that version of Sting sitting up in the rafters and rappelling down from the rafters that was such a big part of that Monday Night War era. You know, when I think of the best matches of Scott Hall's career, the two biggest matches of his career were the first ladder match of WrestleMania and the six-man tag at Bash at the Beach, the night that Hogan joined the NWO. It's not even up for debate. Those are the two biggest matches of the man's career. But his best matches, that's a whole different ball of wax. His best matches, there's three of them at the top of my list. And these are not ranked in any particular order, but these are, in my opinion, the three best Scott Hall matches. All three, by the way, happen to involve Shawn Michaels. The first ladder match with Shawn, the second ladder match with Shawn, and there was a tag team match that aired on an episode of Action Zone in 1994 with all four members of the Click. It was Diesel and Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid. The pace of that match always stood out to me, how quick it was, how fast it was. One of the best tag team matches that you will ever see. And it was Sean Waltman in one of his shoot interviews, it may have been the one with Sean Oliver, who sort of hinted that Scott had a lot to do with laying that match out and putting that match together, as great as it was. But here's a couple more that you should definitely make the time to check out, because I got a lot of questions about that. What Scott Hall matches would you recommend, or what are his top three, his top five, his top 10? Here's a few more for you to chew on. His Monday Night Raw match with Rick Martel in 1993 when he won his first Intercontinental title. I remember that being a pretty good match. His Monday Night Raw match in August of 94 against Shawn Michaels. That was Shawn's first match back since WrestleMania. He had taken basically a break. He was managing Diesel for the entire length of that spring and summer. And then finally he was back in the ring and he wrestled Razor on Raw. And as great as their matches were with a ladder involved, this was just a straight singles match and it was every bit as good as the other ones. That is a great, great match to go find. They did not need any gimmicks to have a great match together. So I was happy that Scott got his moment at the Hall of Fame to give his own speech in 2014. So many others never get that chance if they go in. You know, the Hall of Fame means different things to different people. But if you are selected to go in, at the very least, even if you are of the mindset that I don't care about the Hall of Fame, it's all just a figment of Vince McMahon's imagination, where is it, he can't visit it, what does it really mean? And all of that is true. But at the very least, you want to be able to give your own acceptance speech. Vader is going into the Hall of Fame this year, but he died before he had the chance to give his own speech. And that sucks. Scott Hall, by all rights, never should have made it onto the stage that night, and not because he didn't deserve it. But he turned things around, and not only did he get inducted into the Hall of Fame as Razor Ramon, he got inducted a second time as part of the NWO. How many people can you think of that have effectively had two careers and had the kind of impact in those two careers that Scott Hall had? You know, he was a big star in WWF is Razor Ramon, and then went on under his real name to have this almost entirely different career for himself that was arguably, you know, even bigger than the first. Not too many people can say that. Which is why he's in the Hall of Fame twice. But the closing line of his Hall of Fame speech is so great, it deserves to be repeated one more time. And I think it's a great way to sum up the life and the career of Scott Hall. Hard work pays off. Dreams come true, bad times don't last, but bad guys do. Tony Khan made his weekly appearance on Busted Open Radio Friday morning, and he announced his plans to relaunch Ring of Honor's weekly television show coming out of its Supercard of Honor pay-per-view next month. He said even though Supercard of Honor runs head-to-head with AEW Rampage that night, He is still forging ahead with the show because it was set prior to his purchasing the company and they had already sold tickets for it, and so he doesn't want to upset those fans. He says he sees it as a transitional show before he relaunches what he hopes will be a new Ring of Honor TV product, which he said would be a weekly series wherever it does air or stream. That's what he said. He gave no further details on where that might be. And he also said there would be a cool way to utilize select members of the AEW roster at the pay-per-view on April 1st. However, he does not plan on AEW and Ring of Honor airing head-to-head on television or wherever on the same night in the future, which, I mean, anybody with a brain could have figured that. I mean, why the hell would he compete against himself? That doesn't make any sense. CM Punk and Bryan Danielson, they're on the AEW roster, and that is where they should be. Although I wouldn't mind them popping in for a cameo here and there in Ring of Honor, given their history. But Punk and Danielson, they belong, you know, where they are at AEW. But I still say Tony Khan should bring Samoa Joe, and Samoa Joe's going to come in. I mean, it's inevitable. It's just a matter of time before Samoa Joe ends up, signing some sort of a deal with Tony Khan, whatever his role ends up being. I think he should bring in Joe and or Cesaro and get them involved in some way on the Ring of Honor side of things, because that brand is going to need a few names. If he planned, now that we know that he is going to relaunch the television show and he is moving full steam ahead as far as running Ring of Honor as its own separate entity. Okay, he's made that very clear. He's going to relaunch the show. He's going to, I assume, start selling tickets to certain shows. Either of those two men would be a great addition, given that they both have a history in Ring of Honor. And as busy as things are right now with the existing AEW roster, I'm not so sure that them just going to AEW is really such a great move right now. They have a lot of people they've signed. They have a lot of people already on the roster. You know, they're going to add Joe and Claudio and Gargano and who knows who else, right? Ember Moon is still out there. How many more people can they add? There's only so many spots to go around on TV. Well, now he's running Ring of Honor. He's got a whole other promotion. And there just so happens to be some of these free agent names out there right now who have a history in Ring of Honor. And if you're going to run a television show and want people to tune in and want to give them a reason to watch the show, you've got to have some names on that show. Joe is a name. Cesaro would be a name. He just had 10 or 11 years of television exposure on WWE television. Built up a lot of goodwill with the audience. People like the guy. He's talented. Either of them would be a great fit, I think, in Ring of Honor. I also think Tony Khan would benefit by bringing somebody else in to help run it either with him or for him. Whether that's somebody like a Gabe Sapolsky or somebody who already works with him behind the scenes in AEW who he thinks might have some booking chops, because I fear that this guy is spreading himself way too thin. Burnout is a very real thing and has done promoters in the past, and that is not what he needs. It never hurts to bring in some help to help run things. And speaking of that Supercard of Honor show, he made it official on Twitter later that afternoon on Friday that the Briscoes are going to get their match against FTR on that show. I was just talking about this a few weeks ago. I said April 1st is the perfect time to do that match, and so now it is official. It will be the Briscoes against FTR. That is going to be for the Ring of Honor World Tag Team Championship. The new House of Glory Tag Team Champion Briscoes, by the way, defending their Ring of Honor titles. Also signed for that show, Jonathan Gresham is going to take on Bandido in a winner-take-all match to determine the undisputed Ring of Honor World Champion. Bandido was the ROH champion, tested positive for COVID, had to be pulled from Final Battle in December. Jonathan Gresham then beat Jay Lethal to become, you know, effectively the interim Ring of Honor World Champion, and so now we're going to have the undisputed Ring of Honor champion crowned. And also on that show, Shane Strickland is going to go one-on-one with Alex Zane. Christopher Daniels, who serves as AEW's Vice President of Talent Relations, announced overnight that AEW and DDT Pro in Japan have reached a working agreement to bring DDT wrestlers to the United States for the first time in AEW. DDT is where Kenny Omega first made a name for himself, and where he and Kota Ibushi each had classic matches against the legendary Yoshihiko, the inflatable sex doll. Oh yes, for those unfamiliar with Yoshihiko, the original one was killed during a match by a knee drop that caused its head to basically explode and burst open. There was a second version of Yoshihiko that was modeled after the great Muda. That version was killed on a Kenny Omega giant swing out of the ring, and it split his head open and caused all the stuffing to fall out. And it was actually during that match that a third incarnation of Yoshihiko debuted, dressed up like the American badass version of The Undertaker, coming out to Kid Rock and everything. And that Yoshihiko was later shot to death by another wrestler. Gives you a little taste of DDT. Maybe we'll get another version of Yoshihiko debuting in AEW, and Jim Cornette's head will spontaneously combust and all the stuffing will come out of his head. AEW set the mark this past week for the largest gate for any pro wrestling event in North America outside of WWE. For its Double or Nothing show in Las Vegas on May 29th, almost 13,000 tickets sold for a gate of over $1.1 million that just edges out the Ring of Honor New Japan G1 Supercard at MSG 3 years ago. And that was with fans from all over the world, you know, traveling in for WrestleMania that weekend. This is more impressive to me because there is no WrestleMania. This is an AEW exclusive weekend in Vegas. So just under 600 tickets remain for the show. It's going to be nice to have it back in Vegas for the first time since the original Double or Nothing. That, you know, they've been forced to do the show, you know, with the full Vegas theme and everything from Daly's place for the past 2 years. And they had the Stadium Stampede stuff next door at the Jaguar Stadium. So, them being back in Vegas may well spell the end of the Stadium Stampede. Or maybe they'll just do Stadium Stampede if they want to keep it as an annual thing. They might have to do it on a different show because they're not going to be in Jacksonville anymore. Jeff Hardy was a guest on the latest episode of Matt Hardy's podcast with John Alba. And in talking about his final night in WWE, he flat out said, he made it very clear, he was not trying to intentionally get released by walking off into the crowd the way he did at that house show. He talked about there being glimmers of hope during his time in WWE, his most recent stint there. He cited last year's Survivor Series, where it came down to him and Seth Rollins. And I remember how fucking over he was in the building that night. Just watching it on, you know, on Peacock, you could hear it come across on TV. But I heard from a couple of people who were there live, and he was easily the most over person in the building that night. That's why I was pushing the idea at the time so hard. They've got to do at least one match, if not a program, leading into WrestleMania between Roman Reigns and Jeff Hardy. They have to do that match before WrestleMania. They could have easily gotten one pay-per-view match at least out of it. You know, out of a Jeff Hardy comeback story where he tries to win, you know, one last major championship. His first universal title before ultimately losing to Roman Reigns, because he wasn't going to beat Roman Reigns, obviously. And it's a match that he himself said he really wanted. He told Steve Austin, that's the match that I want. He wanted to wrestle Roman Reigns. But he says, you know, things felt really good that night at Survivor Series because they were actually doing something with him. Most of the time, he wasn't doing anything. He didn't feel valued. He talked about being at SummerSlam when they were at Allegiant Stadium in Vegas last year, how excited he was to go to Vegas and, oh, SummerSlam in this big stadium. And he had no match. He ended up not even being on the card. He was hoping at least even a small role on the show. And he just ended up hanging out there. And the whole time he's backstage wondering, why am I here? What am I even doing here? Not just here in Vegas, but in WWE. What am I doing here? He says he didn't feel important. But that last night in the company, he just said, I'm ready to go. Ready to go in that I'm ready to leave, you know, the building. It kind of hit him like a lightning bolt. He says, I'm ready to go. And so he went over the railing and he disappeared into the crowd. And he said, naturally, they thought he was on drugs or something, but he wasn't. And I'll say it again, because everyone was beating up on WWE for it. I don't fault WWE for thinking the worst with Jeff Hardy and doing what they did. Did they jump the gun? Absolutely. It was. I still don't understand why they didn't just send him home and wait for the test results to come back before firing him. I understand they wanted him to go to rehab. He said no, and so they fired him. But why not wait until the results of that test came back in? That still doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. But my mind would have gone right to the same place that theirs did if I were them. Jeff said it all worked out in the end, though, because now in AEW, he feels valued again. In WWE, he felt like they were just going to keep him around to sell action figures. And he also talked about getting the call from WWE while he was waiting for his 90 days to expire about wanting to put him in the Hall of Fame. Remember, they dangled that carrot in front of him? And he said he actually felt offended by it. He was actually kind of pissed off. It angered him. Because he felt like, you know, now is not the time. I'm not done yet. And, you know, he's not sure, he says, what their reaction would have been if he would have asked them, hey, what happens if I go to AEW first when my 90 days are up? Are you still going to want to put me in the Hall of Fame this year? And then Matt chimed in and said it's more likely they were offering him the Hall of Fame as a way to get him to stay, which, of course, that's what it was. I don't know why Jeff would think otherwise. That's exactly what they fucking did. WWE is not calling Jeff Hardy weeks after they fired him about putting him in their Hall of Fame if they know he's going to go sign with Tony Khan for a Hardy Boys reunion. I mean, give me a fucking break. It was a very transparent attempt to get him to stay in the company. And Jeff wisely, in so many words, told them to fuck off. But, you know, Jeff said he doesn't really care so much about the Hall of Fame. That stuff doesn't really matter to him. But if it ever does happen, and it will, he feels it should be as the Hardy Boys, with himself and Matt together. And I agree with that 100%. It would not feel right to induct him by himself before the Hardys together get a group induction as a team into the Hall of Fame. Even though he had a bigger singles career than his brother did, if Jeff Hardy ever goes into the WWE Hall of Fame, first and foremost, it has to be as part of the Hardy Boys. William Regal was the guest on Talk Is Jericho this week. For what was supposed to be a discussion about his wrestling career, it ended up turning into a discussion about his medical history and his near-death experiences. So much so that there's going to be a second episode. They'll you know, pump out a second one that focuses more on his wrestling career. But this was incredible to listen to. I never knew the extent of the health issues that he had. I knew about his heart. I knew about his neck. I knew about how sick years and years and years ago he got on that tour of India, which is, I think, why WWE didn't go back to India for so many years. He wasn't the only one to get sick on that tour. I want to say that was maybe 2002. So I knew about certain, you know, episodes like that in his career and in his life, but, you know, the extent of those health issues and how close he came to dying on more than one occasion, it's unbelievable. He talked about getting pericarditis back in the late 90s, which is an inflammation of the protective sac around your heart, and how it can scar up that sac, which is not a good thing. I perked up when I heard that because I ended up in the hospital for 3 days a few years back with pericarditis. I talked about it on the podcast at the time. It was back in 2017. And it was the worst pain that I ever experienced in my life. It was more of a pressure than pain. It felt like an elephant was sitting on my chest. I felt like I was having a heart attack. Apparently it mirrors or can mirror the symptoms of a heart attack. So that's what it felt like. And I can tell you, it does not feel good. So it was very scary to hear him talk about that. And in his case, all that scarring around his heart, the pericardium, over time, it sort of locked down and it started to calcify. Yeah, he said he broke his neck in a match with Ricky Steamboat in WCW in 1993, and he never knew it. He never knew his neck was broken. All those years, Lord Steven Regal, his debut in the WWF, everything. He had a broken neck and didn't even know it. Once he figured it out, once he was diagnosed, he needed 4 discs in his neck to be fused together. I mean, it's insane to think that he had a broken neck or fractured neck or whatever for that long and didn't know it, but I think back to Ruby Soho, you know, when she was still Ruby Riott in WWE, and she was gone for a long time because she had double shoulder surgery. She had two torn labrums? It was either labrums or rotator cuffs in each arm, And she wrestled that way for 10 years and didn't even know it. The doctor said, you've had this for a decade. So finally, she had it operated on. But anyway, he had four discs in his neck fused together. And then his wound opened up and he was leaking spinal fluid. And so in 2018, fast forward here, he's on a scouting trip for WWE in Costa Rica. He gets dizzy. He gets off the plane. He gets dizzy because of his heart. He says, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing drugs. I was clean by that point, but it had to do with my heart. And he fell down an escalator at the airport. He shattered his left eye socket. He has no memory of the next 3 weeks. Total amnesia. He lost 40% of the vision in his left eye that still hasn't come back. His vision, he says, is mostly gray out of that eye now. He was still having health issues. Months later, he went to the doctor and they saw something on a scan that didn't look right. And it turns out that sac around his heart, just to bring it back around to that, that sac around his heart had completely calcified. And they told him, if we don't operate to remove the calcified areas, you have less than 6 months left to live. You will not be here 6 months from now. And he had nothing but praise for WWE, saying that they paid for everything, including sending him to a specialist in Atlanta who was one of the premier doctors in the entire country, one of the few to have successfully treated this. He spent 8 weeks in the hospital after that, but he insisted on going home for Christmas. He wanted to be with his family. And that was a mistake, because on New Year's Day, this would have been 2019, he had been in excruciating pain. He fell out of bed. His wife and his son got him into an ambulance. They rushed him to the hospital, where he then developed sepsis in his leg. He got an infection. And the doctors called his wife to tell her that if we don't amputate this guy's leg right away, he's going to be dead within 24 hours. Lucky for him, it just so happened that the wife of one of his usual doctors, who I guess wasn't in that day, the wife was also a doctor. She overheard that phone call. She was in the background. She heard what was going on, so she tells her husband what's going on. All of a sudden, Regal's regular doctor, he quickly calls into the hospital and he says, don't do this. He stopped them from amputating his leg. And I guess whatever he told them to do, they were able to save the leg. Which just goes to show you that every doctor doesn't necessarily know what the fuck they're talking about. But, you know, listening to him tell these stories, it was about an hour and 20 minutes, the episode. I listened to the entire thing. It gave me anxiety. I felt like I needed a pill when I was done listening to this. It gave me so much anxiety. It's insane. When he was in that hospital and they saved his leg, that all happened days before the NXT TakeOver Blackpool show where Walter debuted. And within 2 months, he was back to doing 500 squats again. So he says now his health is as good as it's been in many, many years, which is great to hear. But, you know, like Scott Hall, Regal is someone who abused his body in a way that it was not meant to be abused, with booze and pills, and he probably should not even be here right now. But we're all very thankful that he is. And I think it's great that he has been able to get hit, you know, this one last run in AEW. I love the pairing with Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson. It's probably my favorite thing right now on AEW television. Thunder Rosa won the AEW Women's Championship from Britt Baker in their steel cage match Wednesday night in Rosa's hometown of San Antonio. 1 year after their Lights Out match, they headlined their second Dynamite show together. They brought back the blood. They brought back the thumbtacks, which I could do without. It was a great moment, and I don't think we're done with these two. I think we do get one more match before Rosa moves on to somebody else. Britt probably goes on to fight Jamie Hayter, who it's very clear there's a split waiting to happen right there between those two. And I think Serena Deeb could be next after that to challenge Rosa for the championship. You know, she's been doing these 5-minute professor challenges on Rampage, and I know she's got her feud with Hikaru Shida right now. And maybe Shida will win. Maybe Shida will get her revenge on Serena. She'll win the feud, but I don't know. I feel like Rosa and Serena is a program and a match I would like to see for that women's title. The Hardys had their first match at AEW against Private Party on Wednesday night. Jeff, I mean, the story of this guy's fucking career, incredibly over in the building. This man can do no wrong. The people love, 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 love Jeff Hardy. And look, he and Matt, they're both moving a lot slower than they used to. They're also older. They're in their 40s, so that's to be expected. When they're this popular, they don't have to be quick like they used to be. They can play the greatest hits, and the fans are going to eat it up. They're an attraction. Jeff coming in has breathed new life into Matt's career. The best thing to ever happen to Matt Hardy's career in AEW is Jeff Hardy coming into AEW. MJF and Sean Spears, predictably, they screwed Wardlow out of a TNT Championship win against Scorpio Sky on Wednesday night. So we are headed to the eventual singles match between Wardlow and MJF. I think, again, there should have been no real surprise with that finish on Wednesday. I didn't think Scorpio Sky was made champion just to be a transitional champion, and MJF, it was pretty clear to me, was going to get his revenge on Wardlow for what Wardlow did to him at Revolution. So that story is progressing and playing out exactly the way that I thought it would. Chris Jericho, I thought, had a pretty good explanation in his segment with all of his new friends in the Jericho Appreciation Society, explaining the origins of the name. And it is a terrible name for a faction, but they did take the time to explain why each member, the members of 2.0, Jake Hager, Daniel Garcia, why they would appreciate Chris Jericho. So that aspect of it I liked. At least they offered up an explanation for why the hell these guys came together. Moxley and Danielson, they beat Chuck Taylor and Wheeler Yuta of Best Friends, and they teased when it was over. You know, Yuta went back into the ring. He wanted to shake hands with William Regal. Regal slapped him right in the neck. It's not really in the face. Have you ever watched a William Regal slap? Probably to protect the guy. He smacks him right in the neck, but my God, did this make a noise. Holy shit. So he smacked him and basically said, why don't you go get some more experience? And then maybe we could do something together. So again, teasing the possibility, teasing the idea that maybe Regal and Moxley and Danielson are going to start taking some young guns under their wings soon. I think that would be great. Rampage on Friday night did not start up until almost midnight because of NCAA basketball. We had a rare countout finish on an AEW show with Darby Allin hitting a coffin drop to the Butcher on the floor. And the Butcher was unable to make it back into the ring before the 10 count, which spared him from taking a pinfall loss. Red Velvet over Layla Hirsch. That keeps the issue alive between Hirsch and Chris Statlander, who came out and took the turnbuckle weapon away from Layla when she tried to use it again. The House of Black got a quick win. Yeah, like a showcase win over Bear Country and Fuego del Jobber. And Keith Lee got himself his first AEW main event on television, beating Max Caster of the Acclaimed. Lee got into it with Powerhouse Hobbs after the match before Ricky Starks got involved. The Acclaimed attacked. Lee was overwhelmed until Shane Strickland ran out with a chair and the heels all scattered. So you didn't miss anything important if you missed this show, and they wisely didn't give much away because they knew this show was airing in a death spot. I mean, again, it was like 11:48, almost midnight on a Friday night when this show hit the airwaves. If this show doesn't do the lowest Rampage rating of all time, I would be stunned. Anything higher than a record low for this Rampage from Friday, they should be happy with that number. Now, coming out of Rampage, we have a main event for Dynamite this Wednesday of Sting, Darby Allin, and the Hardys against Private Party, the Butcher, and the Blade in an 8-man Texas Tornado match. The last Texas Tornado match they did was at Revolution, and Sting did a balcony dive. This time, I think it may be Jeff Hardy who tries something crazy. Chris Jericho and Daniel Garcia take on Alex Reynolds and John Silver of the Dark Order. And MJF will speak for the first time since his loss to CM Punk at Revolution. Punk, by the way, is off shooting scenes for the second season of Heels. That's the Stephen Amell show. That would explain why he hasn't been on television since the pay-per-view. But I think that's fine because I don't think we need to see him every week on TV anyway. This week's podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Get started today at betterhelp.com/Solomonster and get 10% off your first month. I think most of us, you know, if we knew that we had a close friend or a family member who needed help, we would drop everything and try to help them. And yet, we might not drop everything to get the help that we need for ourselves. Why is that? This month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you, as I do, to take care of your most important relationship. That's the one that you have with yourself. Whether it's hitting the gym or trying therapy, your greatest asset is you. So it's about time that you invested some effort into yourself the way that you do for other people. That's why I was so eager to get back to the gym once mine opened back up last year. A lot of people packed on the pounds. They let themselves go over the past 2 years. I tried to make sure I went the opposite way. But that's only one way to make sure that you're taking care of yourself. Therapy is another. Therapy is another. It's not just the physical aspect. It's the mental aspect as well. Body and mind. That's why they say body and mind, right? You can't really have one without the other. You need both. And I know, look, it's still a taboo subject for a lot of people. They see it as almost like a sign of weakness. Ooh, you know, therapy, I would never do something like that. That's a weak way of thinking about it. There's nothing weak about asking for help when you need it. In fact, just the opposite. It takes a lot of guts and a lot of courage to do that. And I was blown away by how many people I heard from after I first talked about BetterHelp last year who said they either tried the service with our link or they were already using it, they were already a customer, and how much it really helped them. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anybody on camera if you don't want to. You don't even have to leave your own home. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. So give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp Online Therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and right now, Solomonster Sounds Off listeners get 10% off their first month when they use our link. So go to betterhelp.com/Solomonster. That's BetterHelp. .com/Solomonster. And I meant what I said. I heard from people who never even tried therapy last time who raved about it. So I'm hoping by working together again with the BetterHelp team, we can help even more people. Whatever issues you may be dealing with, everybody's got something in their life right now that they're dealing with. WWE announced this week that Queen Charmelle will be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame this year, joining Vader and The Undertaker in this year's class. She broke into the business as one of the Nitro girls under the name Storm, and later as Paisley, and she managed her husband Booker T in both WWE and TNA. Not too many husband and wife combos in the Hall of Fame. In fact, I think Edge and Beth Phoenix is the only married couple to be in the Hall of Fame. I think Booker and Charmelle would be number two. Booker T credits Charmelle with the success of the King Booker gimmick in 2006. Without her, there would be no King Booker, which is the gimmick that won him a world title that year, when it looked like his career was winding down and he himself said he was ready to basically hang it up. It gave him a whole new lease on life, and he won the big gold belt. The only other thing of note that I can remember her character being involved in was when Kurt Angle was obsessed with her and said some unsavory things that would never be said on television today. I can't believe they were said on television then. But she does have the distinction of being part of one of the worst matches in the history of Earth in TNA, against Jenna Maraska at Victory Road in 2009. And it was awful almost entirely due to Jenna Maraska. I'm not even sure Prime Ric Flair or Shawn Michaels could have saved that match with Jenna in there. But these days, she helps Booker run their Reality of Wrestling school and promotion, which has seen a lot of men and women go on to get contracts with WWE. In fact, they just signed another Reality of Wrestling alum just this week, Roxy. The former Ring of Honor Women's Champion is now officially signed with WWE. But the chatter is getting louder about a possible Steiner Brothers induction, which I talked about last week. And I went back and I read that clip of what Scott Steiner once said about the Hall of Fame, and I cracked myself up all over again. But a lot of you seem to enjoy that segment from Sound Off 502 that I replayed last week about what Scott Steiner really thinks of the WWE Hall of Fame. We'll see if Sid or the Steiners get the nod this year, because that was the rumor, at least over these last couple of weeks. Some other news and notes. WWE filed a motion this week to dismiss the lawsuit that MLW brought against them, alleging a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, alleging that WWE also caused the cancellation of their deal with 2BTV, which is owned by Fox, as well as caused Vice TV to back away from a possible deal with MLW, thus causing a loss in revenue that would have come from those deals. And it only took a lawsuit from MLW for it to finally happen. But WWE, for the first time this week, acknowledged that AEW has, in fact, been a success. Oh, the AEW haters are not going to like this. They are not, they're gathering as we speak. They're trying to regroup here and plot out their next move. I don't know what they're going to do. But they claimed in their filing, MLW does not plausibly allege that barriers to entry exist. AEW's success further undercuts MLW's unsupported assertion that substantial barriers to entry exist. The complaint alleges that WWE's popularity has declined over the last 5 years. It goes on to say that during the same period, AEW entered the proposed market and successfully sold broadcast rights to Warner Media. Subsequently, AEW managed to capture an average 2020 rating of 0.344 compared to WWE Raw's 0.5075 in the key 18 to 49 demographic. This successful entry and expansion refutes the existence of substantial barriers to entry. They brought up the demo. I love it. I fucking love it. They cited the demo that everybody trashes. You know, when you have these ratings wars every, whatever, Thursday afternoon that erupt on social media. I don't even talk about it anymore because it's just so fucking toxic, but holy shit, I love it. I love that they brought up the demo in this filing. And the exhibit, this is even better. The exhibit that WWE included in their motion to the court was the October 18, 2021 issue of the Wrestling Observer newsletter. WWE is using the Observer as evidence in court, covering the time that WWE lost 30 minutes head-to-head with AEW as evidence that they are, in fact, not a monopoly. So basically, they're citing how successful AEW has been, including the creation of Rampage as a second television series and their recent purchase of Ring of Honor, as examples of why WWE is not a monopoly and why MLW's claims have no merit. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to what evidence MLW can produce in court. Whether or not they win this case outright or they get a nice settlement out of it. But WWE is going to force them to produce something. And if they don't have it, if they don't have, you know, records of some kind, emails or text messages or something like that, then this lawsuit is going nowhere. Former ECW and Impact star Simon Diamond, Pat Kenny, who currently works as the head of talent relations for the NWA, suffered what he described as a mild stroke on Friday, and he was hospitalized for several days. He has since been sent home, and per PW Insider, is currently dealing with impaired vision. He was obviously not able to be present for the NWA Crockett Cup events this weekend, both of which are airing on Fight TV. Last night was night one. Tonight is night two, with Matt Cardona defending his NWA title against Nick Aldis, with Jeff Jarrett as the guest referee. Camille defends her NWA women's title against Chelsea Green and Kylie Rae, plus the semifinals and finals of the Crockett Cup Tag Team Tournament, with the Briscoes taking on the Cardonas and La Rebellion taking on the Commonwealth Connection of Doug Williams and Harry Smith. Killer Cross is headed to New Japan Pro Wrestling, more specifically New Japan Strong, and its Lone Star Shootout in Dallas on April 1st. He dropped a video this week showing him laying out a bunch of trainees in a gym and challenging Minoru Suzuki to a match. Why would you do such a thing? Who in their right mind would challenge Minoru Suzuki? But Killer Cross has done just that. Now, we don't know if this is a one-shot for now or if this is a full-time deal that he signed with them. Buddy Matthews wrestled Okada at their Battle in the Valley a few months ago, but then he ended up signing with AEW. You know, Cross has popped up at a few places recently, including MLW, so this reads to me like it's just a case of, you know, he's going to come in, he's going to do a few shots for New Japan, but otherwise he'll continue to, you know, book his own independent dates elsewhere, and he may well end up signing a full-time contract with somebody else. But I like the idea of Cross with New Japan. And that show will be available to stream on Fight TV. And sadly, Scott Hall was not the only recent wrestling-related death. J.J. Maguire, which is a name that a lot of you may not be familiar with. You may never have heard this man's name ever in your life. But if you were a WWF fan or a WCW fan in the 80s and the 90s, I can guarantee that you heard some of his music. You may not have known that it was him, but you definitely heard some of his music. He died unexpectedly on March 11th. At the age of 68, he first met Jimmy Hart as a member of the Gentrys, which is Jimmy's old band that he was part of. Jimmy did the vocals for the band. That's before he even got into wrestling. When using some of the real songs that WWF was using in the 80s, got to be very expensive. Remember, Hulk Hogan used to come out to Eye of the Tiger. That's one of many real songs they used to use. Vince McMahon went to Jimmy and said, why don't you and JJ, your partner over there, why don't you guys come up with some stuff for a second wrestling album? The first wrestling album had done very well. They were going to work on a second one. That album, that second one, turned out to be the Pile Driver album. I still have my cassette tape. That's how fucking old I am. I have my Pile Driver cassette tape laying around somewhere. But that album turned out to be, it had some of the most iconic WWE themes. And when you look at the body of work that J.J. Maguire, you know, was part of, as far as his wrestling body of work, again, some of the most iconic themes in wrestling history. Shawn Michaels' Sexy Boy theme. Dusty Rhodes in WWE, his Common Man boogie. The Hart Foundation theme. The theme for the Million Dollar Man. Money, money, money. The Honky Tonk Man, Demolition, one of the best fucking songs of all time. The Legion of Doom, among many others, all were written by Jimmy Hart and J.J. Maguire. And he also helped write Hulk Hogan's American Made theme that he used in WCW. So the way it works is that J.J. would write the music and he would play the instruments. Jimmy would do the vocals for some of them and he worked on the lyrics. So for as much credit, and rightfully so, as Jim Johnston gets for being this, you know, creative genius on the music end and really creating the soundtrack for a lot of our young wrestling fandoms, Jimmy Hart and J.J. Maguire, they played a big part in that too. So very sad to hear that he passed away. Now, WWE paid tribute to Scott Hall just as the word came down that he had passed away. They had a graphic up at the start of Raw on Monday night. And later on, Corey Graves, he almost lost it on camera when he was throwing to a video package for Scott Hall. That was very well done, given how quickly they had to throw that together. Now, I'm sure they had started putting something together the day before when the news first broke about him being placed on life support. It's pretty commonplace in the news industry to put together obituaries for celebrities and political figures, you know, especially the older they are. So when they die, all they have to do is just edit some stuff into it. You know, believe me, there's a lot of obituaries that are on standby right now for a lot of ex-presidents and a lot of very famous figures. It's morbid, but it's pretty common. It happens all the time. Raw was in Jacksonville, and everybody who got themselves worked up into a frenzy, they worked themselves into a shoot, brother. Everybody who worked themselves into a frenzy about Cody Rhodes, they were left bitterly disappointed when the show was over and there was no Cody Rhodes. But I got news for you. WWE never announced that he would be there. So if you sat through 3 hours of this show waiting for Cody to show up, you have only yourself to blame for that because WWE never said he would be there. I never said he would be there. You only thought he would be there. But we now have the definitive update on the status of Cody Rhodes. This from Mike Johnson of PW Insider, who posted on Friday that Cody Rhodes has signed with WWE. He is signed, sealed, and delivered. This is according to multiple sources that he has in the company. He says Cody signed his deal about 2 weeks ago, and the current plan is to have Cody debut WrestleMania weekend, with the early word among those in the company being that he will be on the Raw brand. Now, Fightful says that the plan is for him to appear on the Raw after WrestleMania. I assume that is in addition to whatever he's going to do at WrestleMania and not just on the Raw after. I mean, I guess it's possible that he could be on the Raw after only and not WrestleMania, but that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense given that Seth Rollins has nothing to do. So I assume that he'll be on both. And, you know, hearing that he's probably going to end up on Monday Night Raw, who do you have for him to work with on Raw? You got a lot of options. You've got AJ Styles. You've got Edge. A newly heel Edge, too, which is even better if Cody comes in as a babyface. Randy Orton, who he has a history with. Kevin Owens. And, of course, you've got Seth Rollins. The same Seth Rollins, who still has no opponent for WrestleMania after losing to Kevin Owens in the main event on Monday Night Raw this week. It was a very good match built around a mind-numbingly stupid storyline. We had two men fighting over the right to host a talk show at WrestleMania with Stone Cold Steve Austin. And I get that it's Stone Cold Steve Austin, but still, two of the biggest stars in the entire company, that was the premise for the main event on Monday, arguing over who would get to host a talk show at WrestleMania. Early in the night, Rollins had a vision. First, he pitched the idea maybe of resurrecting his old Rollins Report show and having Stone Cold as his guest. And Kevin Owens shot that down because he said Stone Cold was his guest. He said Austin was coming for him. You can't have him. These two were out there fighting over Austin like two guys fighting over the same girl. Maybe they'll buy him dinner and they'll take him to the movies too. Then Stone Cold can decide which one he wants to go with, like they do on The Bachelor. Austin only has one rose that he can give. We can get Austin on the go-home show to hand the rose to the man that he most wants to beat up and give a stunner to at WrestleMania. See, now, if they were really concerned, if these two were really concerned about getting on the WrestleMania card this year, they should have pitched the idea of a match against each other. Instead of giving it away on TV on Monday. That way they would have guaranteed themselves a spot on the WrestleMania card. It was still a good match, which Owens won with the stunner. And with Rollins left hopeless in the ring, the announcers, boy, they went in hard on the Cody puns. They talked about his WrestleMania hopes being dashed. And how the vision had turned into a nightmare for Seth Rollins. They weren't really being very subtle about it. Whatever Seth Rollins is going to be doing at WrestleMania, it will clearly involve Cody Rhodes. And to that point, there is a Reddit poster who goes by the name Kermit, who posted some potential WrestleMania spoilers. Not about match outcomes or anything like that, but about certain things that are planned and when they are planned, either for night one or night two, and what position on the show. Now, people post things all the time on social media. It doesn't mean that they know what they're talking about. I mean, you can, you know, if you want to get some news from, you know, Catman 456799989992 with his egg as his avatar, you know, I heard that he's got a great update on WrestleMania if you want to go listen to what Catman has to say. So there's plenty of people on social media who post a lot of shit, who claim to have sources and don't know what the fuck they're talking about. So why am I bringing this up? What caught my eye? What caught my attention? And the only reason I'm even mentioning this is that after posting this, the Reddit mods jumped in to say that this person had reached out to them and they provided enough evidence that the mods felt comfortable keeping the post up and saying that Kermit is a verified, reliable insider. They don't just do that with anybody. And so, with that being said, if you want to avoid any and all kinds of potential WrestleMania spoilers, skip ahead by about 5 minutes. According to this person, Seth Rollins against Cody Rhodes will happen on WrestleMania Sunday. Becky Lynch against Bianca Belair is slated to open the show on WrestleMania Saturday. And the segment with Kevin Owens and Stone Cold Steve Austin is slated to close night one on WrestleMania Saturday. If that is true, and that is a big if, then whether the bell rings or not, this has to be, for all intents and purposes, a match between Steve Austin and Kevin Owens. Now, maybe Austin didn't want to commit to a match in advance out of fear that people might get their hopes up and he couldn't deliver for them, but, you know, he's going to end up doing one anyway, and everybody will be happy because, oh my God, I wasn't expecting Stone Cold to have a match. This is so great. You know, I mean, the 19 years stuff, the 19 years comments by Corey Graves on commentary 2 weeks ago, it's all very weird. But you cannot headline a WrestleMania with a talk show segment or a few quick punches or kicks by KO before he eats a stunner. There has to be more to it than that if they're going to close the show with it. The winner of the Royal Rumble is supposed to go to the main event of WrestleMania. Brock Lesnar won the Royal Rumble. He is going to wrestle Roman Reigns in the main event, the true main event of WrestleMania on night two. That's already set in stone. But we don't have one Royal Rumble anymore. We have two. We have one for the men. We have one for the women. Ronda Rousey won the Women's Royal Rumble match this year. So Ronda Rousey and Charlotte Flair, which I have not been in any way excited by the build to this match, that should be the main event of WrestleMania on night one. However, I did mention one caveat a few months ago when I ranted about this, because I do believe that if you win the Royal Rumble, you should close out WrestleMania. Honor the stipulation. Don't just call it a main event and then you have your Royal Rumble winner open the fucking show or something ridiculous like that. I'm tired of that. But when I talked about that, I had one little caveat. I said that sometimes you have an attraction so big that it can't possibly be slotted anywhere else but the main event. Case in point, The Rock coming back to wrestle John Cena in 2012. Even though Sheamus won the Royal Rumble that year, Sheamus was not going to close out WrestleMania when The Rock was having his first singles match in 8 years, because that would have been ridiculous. For The Rock, you make an exception. Likewise, if he's actually going to wrestle, you make an exception for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Because if he's going to throw down, it don't get no bigger than Stone Cold back in the ring in Texas. Outside of Brock Lesnar against Roman Reigns and Edge against AJ Styles, the only other things that even have me remotely interested in the WrestleMania card this year are whatever Steve Austin is doing, and the possibility that Cody Rhodes might show up and do something. That's it. That's where my interest level is right now in this WrestleMania card this year. They did Omos against Commander Aziz on Raw Monday night, which surprised me. I thought they would save that for WrestleMania or the Andre Battle Royal, if there is one. They haven't announced one yet. But they gave it away here, the Battle of the Giants, which was thankfully kept short. There was an impressive spot where Aziz went for a suplex, but Omos reversed it into a suplex-like slam of his own. It looked like he almost dropped him, but he muscled him up and slammed him, and that was impressive. And then he pinned Aziz with the tree slam finish, and he laid out Apollo Crews after the match, for good measure. Not a good sign for Apollo Crews, when this is really the only thing I could think of that he's done on television in months. Not a good sign for Apollo Crews, I don't think, coming out of WrestleMania. But this is the best use of Omos right now, keeping his stuff as short as possible. Edge has new theme music to fit his new heel persona. He's stuck with Alter Bridge. He's now using their song, The Other Side. Not to be confused with the Red Hot Chili Peppers song of the same name. And the lyrics really seem to suit him very well. You know, you're insane. Have you gone too far? Who's to blame for what you are? They also changed the opening of his song, The You Think You Know Me soundbite. They changed it to Edge himself saying, "You think you know me? You never did." And he called himself the benchmark of WWE. He tried to satisfy the fans, but all that did was make him weak. It was the fans' fault that Randy Orton injured his triceps, or that he injured his triceps in his match against Randy Orton when he had the greatest wrestling match of all time. It was the fans' fault. It was the fans' fault that Seth Rollins broke into his house, and it was the fans' fault that Roman Reigns stacked him and pinned him at WrestleMania last year. He said if that Edge wrestled AJ Styles at WrestleMania, he would also lose. He said that version of Edge is dead. And if AJ Styles does make it to WrestleMania, he will be judged. And he threw the line in there again about the mountain of omnipotence, but that aside, this was better than his promo from the week before. And Styles is promising to be back on Raw tomorrow night. The fact that they went through the trouble of giving Edge the new entrance with the new music and everything, if they're going all in on heel Edge, I think it bodes well for him going over at WrestleMania in that match. We got another match between Bianca Belair and Doudrop, with the same finish of Belair lifting Doudrop on her shoulders and delivering the KOD. You know, it was cool the first two times they did it. This is what now, the third or fourth time, I believe? Leave it to them to take something cool and drive it into the fucking ground. Becky Lynch attacked Belair after the match, wrapped a chair around her neck, around her head, before sending her throat first into the ring post. Becky had suffered a legitimate injury to her throat at a house show a few weeks ago, so she was paying Bianca back for it here, and WWE has since announced that Bianca suffered a fractured hyoid bone in her throat. They say although Belair will not need surgery, she will be out of action for an unspecified period of time as she recovers from her injury. Oh, I'd say about 2 weeks is what that unspecified period of time is going to be before we see her back in the ring. The Alpha Academy interfered in the match between Matt Riddle and Montez Ford, and they left both teams laying, which is good because that means they won't be completely forgotten about at WrestleMania. Now they can work Gable and Otis into the Raw Tag Team title match with RK-Bro and the Street Profits. I'm not even sure that match has officially been announced yet. I mean, we're 2 weeks out from WrestleMania, two nights, and there's still a ton of matches that haven't officially been announced yet. No U.S. title match, no Intercontinental title match. I don't believe there's been any SmackDown Tag Team title match made officially unless they did it on Twitter or something, and I'm not aware. So I'm assuming that that will end up being the Raw Tag Team title match. And then we had the main event that I mentioned earlier between Owens and Rollins. But not before Kevin Owens, I have to mention this, not before Kevin Owens made his entrance for this main event, just after 10:30 p.m., he then proceeded to stand out there in the ring through two commercial breaks, an ad for Steve Austin's new lager, and a long video recap, which included the segment that we already saw 90 minutes earlier with these two, and a medical update on Bianca Belair. The bell did not ring to signal the start of the main event until 10:43. The way they format and lay out these shows is absolute dog shit. But let's be honest, the formatting is hardly the only problem or the biggest problem on Monday Night Raw. SmackDown on Friday night. You want my full recap? It is up on the YouTube channel. I reviewed SmackDown only on Friday night since Rampage was airing so late. But we got Farmer Brock was back. Farmer Brock looked so happy in his forklift. I feel like somebody can do a children's story about Farmer Brock driving around in his tractor and hunting deer and doing whatever else it is that Farmer Brock does on the land all day long. He had a big smile on his face driving a forklift into the SUV that the Bloodline had just gotten into when they found out that Brock was on his way. And so they cheaped out on the whole collision. They promoted this collision all week long between Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar. There was no collision. The only collision was the forklift ramming into the SUV. I guess that was your collision from Friday night. But I thought the angle was fine. I mean, if they want to keep these two apart, and I don't know that they do. I mean, they may end up getting into blows on TV this week. But if the idea is from here on out, after the angle they shot at Madison Square Garden. If from here on out they don't want these two to touch, they don't want any physicality between Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns, then they have to get creative with how they go about doing that. And I thought this angle was fine. It showed, you know, Brock's rage as they drove off and he ripped the door off the side of the SUV as it pulled away. And anyway, I thought Brock was great in that segment. Sami Zayn challenged Johnny Knoxville to make their match at WrestleMania an anything goes match, which Knoxville later accepted, all but guaranteeing that we're going to see a bunch of other jackasses involved in this match, probably Wee Man, and I think Wee Man may be the only other one I know. Is Bam Margera, is he one of the jackass people? Isn't he the one who Hulk Hogan tweeted years ago he thought he was dead? Rest in peace, and Bam was like, I'm still alive, brother. There's a really good tag team match, Sasha Banks and Naomi against Rhea Ripley and Liv Morgan, with a disqualification finish when Natty and Shayna got involved, and they have now been added to the women's tag team title match at WrestleMania. It will be those three teams plus Carmella and Zelina defending their tag team titles. Pat McAfee was forced by Vince McMahon to issue an apology to Austin Theory for what he did to him attacking him the week before, and McAfee issued the weakest apology that you've ever heard, and he called him a punk bitch, and Theory shoved him and then ran away after taking a selfie. Very exciting. And Charlotte Flair, the story there is that she still cannot get Ronda Rousey to tap out. No matter what she does to this woman, she beat her up again and beat her up with a kendo stick and tried to choke her out, and Ronda would not tap. And Charlotte powerbombed her through the announce desk to end the show. And I am not feeling this feud at all. They may go to WrestleMania and have an excellent match, but the build-up to this thing, and especially Ronda Rousey, especially when she's on the mic and she's trying to hit all of her talking points, I don't know. There's nothing exciting or interesting about any of this. The story they're telling about whether or not Ronda can, you know, bust out an extra move or two and try to beat Charlotte, who cares? You know, I mean, there's nothing. Look, I think back to when Ronda and Becky were feuding on social media. And that was the match that everybody wanted to see. They wanted Becky Lynch against Ronda Rousey. When those two were in the ring together on Raw, I remember the crowd exploding when they were teasing the possibility of the two of them having a match at WrestleMania. It might have been after the Royal Rumble in 2019. And we still never got that singles match. And I know there's talk about them waiting until next year in Los Angeles and doing it there, you know, when WrestleMania goes Hollywood and all that. And a year is a long time. You know, who knows what Becky will be doing and Ronda, and, you know, maybe they can get people excited for it again. But if they do the match next year, I mean, that's going to be 4 years after the point in which they should have done the match. Are people going to be excited next year the way they were 3 years ago to see that match? I don't think so. So this stuff with Charlotte and Ronda just feels so very forced to me. Like they're doing the wrong match. I mean, look, I like the fact that Bianca is going to get a finish to that story they seemed to start telling with her at SummerSlam last year. But yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, you strike while the iron is hot. And a lot of things happened. Ronda went away, had a baby, the pandemic hit. So, you know, it's been a few years. But should they have gone with that match this year instead? I don't know. You know, would I be any more excited to see that match than I am Ronda and Charlotte? Maybe not. But this ain't working for me. NXT 2.0 this week. Even more Raw talent has been sent over to the show. I mean, before it was one guy here and there. And now it's basically what we have now. I mean, think about this. We had a Miz TV segment with The Miz on Tuesday. It was The Miz, Dolph Ziggler, who was the new NXT champion, and Bobby Roode. Then later, we had Rey and Dominic Mysterio on the show. This is after the program with AJ Styles against Grayson Waller. So we basically have Raw on Mondays and Raw Lite on Tuesdays is what this show has become. And I'm okay with the occasional rotating in of main roster talent, but boy, they're really loading this show up with it. But Miz TV was interrupted by LA Knight, who is a total superstar out there. And that set up our main event for the NXT Championship later in the show between LA Knight and Dolph Ziggler. Cora Jade, interviewed by Mackenzie Mitchell, talking about the attack by Mandy Rose last week. And Cora noted that her partner Raquel Gonzalez is going to be out of action, injured for 4 to 6 weeks. And she said that she was going to avenge Raquel. And she knows that Toxic Attraction is going to come after her. And so the story is that she stole the titles. Toxic Attraction, they have the women's championship. They have the women's tag team titles. Cora Jade stole the belts. And one by one, each member of Toxic Attraction was going to have to come find her and get it. And what followed were a pair of Home Alone-style segments with Cora Jade setting traps for the various members of, you know, she set one for JC Jane and trapped her in the building. And then she set one for Gigi Dolin and trapped her in a dumpster outside the building. Ultimately, though, in the end, when she was about to take Mandy's car for a joyride, Mandy was in the back seat and surprised her and ended up beating her up and leaving her laying. So that's how they set things up, I guess, for what's going to be the women's title match coming up, probably at Stand and Deliver, between Mandy Rose and Cora Jade. There was a really good match on this show. Santos Escobar beat Cameron Grimes to qualify for the North American Championship ladder match at Stand and Deliver. Really good stuff. Later on in the back, Legado del Fantasma was being interviewed when all of a sudden, and Escobar referred to himself as the greatest luchador of all time. And then almost on cue, here comes Rey and Dominic Mysterio into camera frame. And words were exchanged. One thing led to another. We ended up getting a match between Dominic and Raul Mendoza. Dominic is somebody who belongs in NXT. You know, they brought him in initially. They did stuff with him and Rollins, and then they did the tag team thing with him and Rey, and they won the tag team title. I think they won the tag team titles. I feel like they didn't even have the titles for very long. That's a story that really should have been built up as a special moment, and I barely fucking remember it. That could have been a WrestleMania moment right there. Rey and Dominic, father and son, winning the tag team titles for the very first time, and they blew it. But now that they've already done that, they've told that story already with Rey and Dom on TV, and it looked like Dominic, maybe there was, you know, things going on between them where Dominic might turn against his father. It seems like they've dropped all of that. Now is the time, I think, for Dominic to settle in on NXT. NXT is really where he belongs right now. That's where he should be. But if they're going to bring in some of this main roster talent and rotate them out on this show, one match that I got excited about when I saw them face to face here, and I absolutely want them to give me this match, is Rey Mysterio against Santos Escobar. Give me Rey and Escobar. And that will make me very happy. A-Kid from NXT UK made his NXT proper debut. He got a win over Kushida. This was a qualifier for the qualifier, because now A-Kid moves on to face Grayson Waller this Tuesday, with the winner of that match advancing to Stand and Deliver and the ladder match for the North American title. A qualifier for a qualifier. Interesting. From what little I've seen of A-Kid, he seems very good, but he didn't get too much time to show it here. This went about 3 or 4 minutes. And then came probably the most ridiculous moment on this show. We know that Saray has this new gimmick where she has this magic necklace from her grandmother, I guess, that gives her special powers. It's, you know, whatever. She does the thing where she's dressed like a schoolgirl in the back, and then as she's making her entrance for her match, there's smoke, and when she emerges, she's in her wrestling gear. She went to go do that this week. She was getting ready. She was in the back, getting ready to come out. She got attacked from behind by Tiffany Stratton. And as Saray stumbles through the entranceway into the arena, she's getting her ass kicked by Stratton, and she's still dressed like the schoolgirl. Vic Joseph on commentary, and I quote, says, "Saray, not even able to transform." What is she, a fucking alien? She's not even able to transform. She was then beaten and pinned by Tiffany Stratton. This was fucking dumb. It's gimmick fucking city on this show. Tommaso Ciampa came down to the ring. He sat on the top turnbuckle and he cut what sounded very much like a farewell promo to NXT. He talked about his 7 years on the brand. He said it's been a long journey of ups and downs and setbacks and surgeries. And obviously the transition to the transformation to 2.0. Ciampa said the constants were him not leaving and the crowd not leaving. They chanted, please don't go. And Ciampa said he actually doesn't know where he's going to go. Ciampa said he thought that he would know when the end of his run at NXT would come, but, you know, when his fairy tale ending was going to be. And he said that the perfect fairy tale ending should have been walking in to Stand and Deliver as the NXT champion, but that opportunity now is gone. Said he was supposed to walk into WrestleMania weekend as the champion once before, take over New York, but he had to relinquish the title due to injury. He said he's here to say thank you before it's too late. Said he means it from the bottom of his heart to everybody. Thank you. Tony D'Angelo randomly popped up behind Ciampa. He was holding a crowbar. And D'Angelo dropped it and he grabbed the mic. And he said, you know, I could have hit you with this thing, but I respect you. He said he's been wondering the last few weeks, who I have to beat to put myself in the history books. And he said he sees Ciampa as that guy. And D'Angelo said Ciampa has been the man of NXT for a while. It would be an honor for he and Ciampa to wrestle at Stand and Deliver. And Ciampa shook his hand. And D'Angelo pulled him in and kneed him in the groin. And Tony D grabbed Ciampa by the head. And he stared him in the face and said that he's going to become the new Don of NXT. That he kissed Ciampa on his bald head and left him laying. Ciampa could be finishing up with NXT at Stand and Deliver and moving up to Raw or SmackDown. Ciampa and Gargano really were the heart and soul of the Black and Gold. And the Black and Gold is dead. We know that. And Johnny Gargano left because he realized, you know, that was a sign that even he recognized there was no real spot for him in this new NXT. This new NXT did not resemble anything like what he signed up for. Ciampa, at least, you know, he got that little extra title run out of it so that he could properly put over their new heir apparent in Bron Breakker. It's the only reason they put the belt on Ciampa in the first place. They wanted somebody from the old guard who had credibility, who the people liked, and saw as a star on the brand to be the one to do the honors for the new guy. And that's what he did. He served his purpose. And now that he's done that, it's time to move on. Indy Hartwell got a win over Persia Parada. What a fucking segment this was. So they come out together, because usually they're tag team partners, they're best friends. And they come out and they're bickering, and it ends up turning, you know, into a fight. They go one-on-one. Duke Hudson comes to ringside, and Indy doesn't like Duke and doesn't... I guess there's supposedly a history there, and she doesn't trust him, but of course, Persia Parada's been slobbering all over this guy now for weeks. So Duke Hudson comes to ringside. Dexter Lumis crawls out from under the ring, and he's staring down Duke Hudson. When Lumis shows up, that distracts Persia Parada long enough for Indy Hartwell to roll her up for the win. And then, when the match is over, we have all four of them in the ring together. We have Indy with Dexter, we have Persia with Duke, and they try to one-up each other. Indy kisses Dexter, and then Persia kisses Duke. But then Indy rips open Dexter's shirt and tackles him and tackles his man meat down on the floor. And then Persia Parada says, well, if you can do, I can do better. And then she also tackles Duke. And now they're both laying on the mat and they're all making out and they're all swapping spit among other potential bodily fluids. And this is how the segment comes to an end. This is the horniest show on television, booked by the man who once told WWE that he could never be drafted to SmackDown because it conflicted with his Bible study classes. Clearly, we have a mixed tag team match on the way. And in the main event, it was Dolph Ziggler defending the NXT Championship against LA Knight. Bobby Roode got involved, which at first, that backfired. Knight countered with a version of the burning hammer. He covered Dolph Ziggler. Roode put Ziggler's foot on the bottom rope to break the count. That saved the title. And in the end, it was a fairly clean win. I mean, not totally clean, obviously. Roode was getting involved here. But, you know, a super kick from Dolph Ziggler put down LA Knight, who got pinned 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring by Dolph. Bron Breakker came out after it was over. He confronted Ziggler, and Rude tried to get in between them. Breaker decked him with a punch. And Breaker said he wants a shot at the championship that he never lost at Stand and Deliver. And Ziggler held up the belt and said, you got it. So that makes that match official. You know, LA Knight is another one like Ciampa who feels like his time is coming to an end on this show. And like Ciampa wrestling Tony D'Angelo at Stand and Deliver, which feels like a loss and a send-off for Ciampa, we may get the same thing with Walter and LA Knight, who had a backstage run-in on this show. And Knight was insulting him and saying, you know, you've got the tools in the ring, but you don't have the charisma. So they're setting something up between the two of them. So here's the matches that we know are official so far for Stand and Deliver on WrestleMania Saturday. Same fucking day as WrestleMania. We're getting an NXT show. Dolph Ziggler against Bron Breakker for the NXT Championship. Tommaso Ciampa against Tony D'Angelo. We have Imperium, MSK, and the Creed Brothers for the NXT Tag Team titles. Cora Jade challenging Mandy Rose for the NXT Women's Championship. And we have a five-way ladder match. I believe it's a five-way. With Carmelo Hayes defending the North American Championship. So far, Santos Escobar is confirmed as one of the participants in that match. This Tuesday, A-Kid wrestles Grayson Waller. The winner will go on to the ladder match. And we're also getting Roderick Strong against Solo Sikoa. And if I had to pick a winner for each of those matches, who do I think is going to advance? I think it's going to be Grayson Waller and Solo Sikoa, because those are two of the new 2.0 faces that have been pushed now for months on television. A-Kid is brand new. I can't see him going over. Roderick Strong, he's also part of that old guard. Roderick Strong is not part of the future of this NXT brand. He's there to put other people over. And as far as Walter against LA Knight, we'll see. It could be a match on television to determine another spot in the ladder match, or it could just be its own standalone match. It's Stand and Deliver. We'll have to wait and see. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could always email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I just want to run through a few quick ones here. Kevin in Albany, New York, has this to say. So Austin is coming back for this thing with KO at WrestleMania. Most people think it's a little fight and that's it, but I don't think they would be this wishy-washy about it if there isn't some behind-the-scenes talk for an actual in-ring return. Maybe they make SummerSlam a WrestleMania-esque show, or we have to see it in Saudi Arabia. But if Austin's coming back, isn't the biggest match Stone Cold Steve Austin against John Cena? I picture a heel Cena. Maybe Austin is getting beaten down by KO and Rollins and Cena's music hits, but he joins in the beatdown. This is ridiculous. Kevin, are you on drugs? Everything about this, I'm going, no. Come on, dude. Not that I'm saying Stone Cold against John Cena wouldn't be a big match. There is 0% chance any of this happens. John Cena is not going heel. John Cena is not wrestling Steve Austin. John Cena is not going heel and joining in an attack on Steve Austin at WrestleMania. None of those things are going to happen. James from Boston. What was the story behind Bill Goldberg's limo glass injury? I heard he was supposed to break the glass with a pen or something, but he made a big mistake and went off script by using his own fist. I don't know about the pen. He was definitely not supposed to put his own fist through the parts of the limo that he did. He improvised that. And he was a moron. And he suffered nerve damage, and he could have lost his fucking hand. And he was out for a long time. That's what happened. And Rodimus Prime from Alexander City, Alabama. Buy, sell, or rent the worst member of the Four Horsemen. Paul Roma, Sid Vicious, or Mongo McMichael? Mongo was the worst. He had more charisma than Roma did, but Roma at least looked like a horseman as compared to Mongo. And he could wrestle. Yeah, Roma had been around for a number of years by that point. He could work. Neither one of them should have been within 50 feet of the Four Horsemen, but I would buy on Mongo as the worst of the three, rent on Roma, and I would sell on Sid. Meaning that I think of those three, Sid was the one who actually, you know, I think fit the most with the horse. I think Sid and Lex Luger, they were not terrible choices for the Four Horsemen. So anyway, those are my thoughts on that. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send me, and you never know when your question might be asked on the air or in some other type of forum. Follow me on Twitter, @Solemonster, @TheSolemonster on Instagram. Those are my only official handles on there. There is time still to become a channel member on YouTube because we are doing a live watch-along. One last reminder here. This Wednesday, March 23rd, 1 p.m. Eastern. You can fix yourself some lunch. Come watch along with me on Peacock. We're going to watch Bret Hart and Steve Austin, one of the greatest matches of all time. WrestleMania 13, the submission match. Blood from a stone pouring down Steve Austin's face. What a match it was. 25 years ago this week. And we will relive it all over again and hang out for a little bit on Wednesday afternoon. And again, more of these watch-alongs for channel members are coming because this is 25 years since 1997, and there were some pretty big matches in 1997. So I thought it would be cool on the, you know, 25-year kind of to commemorate some of these big matches, and there are more of them yet to come. But the next one is coming up on Wednesday. I'm going to be back with all of you for episode 749. We are getting very close to WrestleMania. And so we will see what else is announced on TV this week. 749 to the Sound Off. That's coming up next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week. Thank you for all of the continued support. You guys make this all possible. And I will see you back here very soon for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Funny you bring up LA Knight. You know, LA Knight is a guy who I've spoken very highly of. Would he not be somebody that you think they could use right now on SmackDown? He's not one of their younger guys. Why is he not helping them now when they need the help? I thought developmental and NXT was building for the future. Why is a guy like that still down there? Well, you have this guy who's pretty damn good, has charisma for days, and could help you right now. So why not get him on up? It boggles the mind.
The Solemonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster Sounds Off.